Today, from the Wings Archive, Laurie Garrett on the coming plague, emerging diseases in a world out of balance. Recorded in 1995.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world. Produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
One of the hottest books in the United States recently is Laurie Garrett's The Coming Plague. Garrett, a reporter for Newsday, gave a slideshow last October in San Francisco on the rising tide of infectious diseases. Laurie Garrett.
When we came out of the World War II era, we started setting goals for diseases that we were going to eradicate. And what we meant was, we're going to take a whole species of microorganism and destroy it on planet Earth, right? So that was our goal, that was our biological and strategic plan. We were so convinced of it because it was the Russians that heard that we were going to eliminate malaria and felt they had to come up with a better one. So they said, okay, we're all going to eliminate smallpox. Their luck was they picked the one that was actually doable for biological reasons. And by 1977, it was clear we had eradicated smallpox from planet Earth. So in 78, there was a meeting held called the Alma-Ata Conference, at which representatives of public health from all over the world gathered and resolved a battle strategy. And by this date, we would have eradicated these diseases, and by that date, these diseases and these diseases. And at the top of the list was cholera. It seemed so doable. It was susceptible to antibiotics. It's a bacterial disease. It's carried in filthy water. Clean the filthy water, give people antibiotics, end of cholera, right? So we were supposed to have eliminated this by the 1980s. And in fact, today we have three simultaneous pandemics of three totally different new strains sweeping across the world. We also have learned something we didn't know when we set out to eradicate it, which if we had known, we probably would never have been silly enough to think we could eradicate cholera from planet Earth. And that is that most new strains of cholera appear in this region, the Bengal Sea, India, Bangladesh. It has to do with the ecology of the area and the way the people live in and on the land, which is to say that the water is everywhere and that most human waste goes entirely untreated into the ecology. It turns out the human waste feeds the algal population, and they have huge algal blooms constantly in this area. Well, it also turns out that the Vibrio cholera is capable of exuding all of its water and shrinking itself down in size by 300% and then living inside of algae. So it turns out the Vibrio can go insert itself into the algae and then make its way around the world in tidal blooms, red tides, or, as happened a couple of years ago, get picked up by ships. The ship comes around, docks off Lima, unloads the bilge water. The algae and the Vibrio inside of them get absorbed into local shellfish, and the people eat ceviche, and voila, cholera epidemic. And of course, the next thing that brings things onto the radar screen in policy circles in Washington is the recognition in May of this year that the Ebola virus had made a return after 19 years in the south of Zaire, in the city of Kikwit, rather than where it emerged in 76 in the far north in the city of Yambuku. The virus is an old nemesis, one that holds a special place of concern, even fear, among a lot of scientists because of the tremendous lethality of the virus and the horrific symptoms it produces. The virus specifically inhabits endothelial tissue, which means the lining of your blood vessels and your capillaries, your primary organs such as your heart, and begins gnawing away little holes, which in the first level of infection results in the water draining out. But as the holes get bigger, the whole blood cells pour out and the liver and so on begin to lose all their integrity and sort of melt away. Eventually, people will be hemorrhaging and bleeding externally from every orifice, and it's quite painful, produces horrible fevers, and many people end up entirely deranged in their final hours before death. That derangement produces another layer of fear in the populace when they see these patients. This is Kikwit. Most of the city has no sewer facilities, no running water, no electricity. It's just a giant village. Oh, and it's a village with no industry, no major source of employment for anybody. The way most of the people survive is by walking the ever greater distance to the rainforest because they're cutting it down for firewood, and then finding things that they scavenge from the rainforest and feel they can sell back in town. So what started out in Kikwi was a sense among the medical providers that they were seeing a sudden increase in bloody diarrhea, which they thought was due to a bacteria called Shigella. And with time, they realized that no matter what antibiotic they were using, the Shigella did not retreat, and the patients died. And they had great fear that this new strain of Shigella they had heard rumors of had made its way to Kikwi. There is a new strain of Shigella in the world that is absolutely incurable. So it wasn't off the wall for the physicians of Kikwi to think that the reason the bloody diarrhea patients weren't recovering was because this new mutant strain they'd heard about had made its way to Kikwi. But they weren't really sure, so they called on Dr. Tamfu Muyembe from the University of Kinshasa, one of Zaire's most famous scientists, and asked him to come in and help them figure out what was going on. He arrived in April, took a look around, and said, you know, you might be right. It could be this incurable Shigella, but actually, diarrhea is not the only symptom in these people. It's a much broader range of symptoms, and it kind of reminds me of something I've seen before. And the whole world is extremely lucky for the coincidence that the doctor who came in as the expert had been involved in 1976 in the epidemic in Yambuku, the first known outbreak of Ebola. Had there not been someone who had the expertise to recognize what was going on, it might still be raging in Kikwi and the world might not know anything about it. Muyembe sent word to Belgium, and Belgium sent word to this gentleman, Dr. David Heyman in Geneva at the World Health Organization, an American who is jointly attached to WHO and the CDC. And again, great coincidence, great fortuitousness for all of us. He too had been involved in the 1976 outbreak in Yambuku and had a fair idea of what needed to be done in the face of Ebola. The final member of the triumvirate that ended up bringing this epidemic to a halt is Dr. Barbara Kirsteins from the volunteer group Médecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders, from Belgium. She ended up handling most of the logistics of getting the hospital back into order and cleaning up the actual devastation that had occurred in the medical facilities of Kikwi. The dictator of Zaire, Mobutu, had been looting the country systematically for his entire reign since the 60s. And he personally stole $11 billion from the National Bank. And his cronies stole about the same amount again, with the result that there is no cash in the National Bank of Zaire. So all the civil servants of Zaire, including the doctors and nurses of this hospital, had gone unpaid since 1991. How were they surviving? The way everybody in Zaire is through a kind of well-understood system of graft and corruption. If the good people of Berkeley sent medical supplies in to help out this hospital, the doctors and nurses would take them and sell them in town. And if you came in here as a patient, they would do a diagnosis and say, okay, you're going to need an appendectomy. Somebody in your family needs to get this kind of anesthesia, this kind of antibiotic, some latex gloves, some masks for the operating team. This hospital had no running water, sporadic electricity off a broken generator. There were virtually no antibiotics or supplies in this hospital. In April, when the Shigella, what they thought was Shigella, epidemic was really soaring, the director of the hospital, Dr. Kipasa, ordered a poor, hapless fellow who was a lab tech in the facility to go collect blood samples from these patients that didn't seem to be improving. And somewhere along the way collecting blood samples, he poked himself. A few days later, Kimfumu had a fever of about 102. He was delirious. His abdomen was grossly distended, and they decided he had an intestinal perforation of some kind, so they opened him up for surgery. And they found that his appendix was horribly inflamed, so they did an appendectomy. The next day he was worse. He was practically comatose, soaring fevers at 104, and more distended. And they thought perhaps they'd erred in their surgery, so they opened him up again. And this time he had completely internally hemorrhaged, and everybody in the OR was exposed to his blood, and from there burst the epidemic of Ebola. 73% of the first wave of Ebola cases in this epidemic were healthcare providers. Some of the healthcare providers, in their panic, left this facility and went to the Catholic missionary hospitals in the outer parts of the district that were better supplied. And there the cycle repeated itself with secondary and tertiary nosocomial outbreaks. So the first thing the international team felt compelled to do when they arrived was to fix up the hospital. They kicked out everybody, sent them to other medical facilities who had non-Ebola problems. They set up a cordon sanitaire. They created an isolation ward for all the Ebola patients. Médecins Sans Frontières put the medical staff on salary for the first time in 4 years and set up professional work schedules for the first time, so that people wouldn't work to the point of exhaustion and do what Kimfumu had done, accidentally injure or infect themselves. Also taught them all how to wear the proper protective gear and set up a resting place within the quarantine area for them to relax and recuperate from hours on end in the tropical heat, caring for these dying, often deranged patients. The family members would wait for word, and when they got the word, you know, your relative has died, they would go over to the morgue, which was just the next building over, and this ritual would begin. And in Kikongo, the eldest surviving relative would begin by saying, someone has died, someone has died, then the name has died, has died. Then their relationship, he was my husband, he was my husband. And then his attributes would be shouted and wailed for hours on end. You know, he was a great carpenter, he was a loving husband. And each family member, one by one, would join in, beginning the same way, someone has died, someone has died. So that you would have whole groups wailing for hours on end, which of course the patients were all hearing, as were the medical staff, who had to remain calm, not let the panic overwhelm them. I have to say that some of the physicians did find it more than they could take, and at least one of the foreign international team members suffered a nervous breakdown under the pressure. Everywhere you would go, the same chanting ritual, and then the wailing would be going on. And it was particularly distressing at night because there's no electricity in Kikwit. So 300,000 people would be in pitch darkness. And as you would walk around in the night, you would hear chanting break out over here and then wailing over here. And you would realize at that instant as you walked, somebody just died of Ebola here and someone just died over here. The result was that the collective feel of Kikwit was one of grave concern and panic. When I returned and looked at what the editorials had been writing while I was over there, I was appalled to see the kind of consistent theme of the conservative and right-wing editorials in this country was, you know, what's all this about Ebola? Why, these people already have tons of malaria and TB and HIV, and, you know, there's only going to be a handful of people that die of Ebola. What's the big deal? Well, it was a very big deal to these people. I don't care how much the background rate of infectious diseases is, nothing was more terrifying to the people of Kikwit than this epidemic. And I can guarantee you, if you go back 10 years from now and talk to people, they'll be dating their lives as before the epidemic and after the epidemic.
From the Wings Archive, you're listening to award-winning journalist Laurie Garrett speaking about her 1995 book, The Coming Plague. In 2014, Garrett updated her work on Ebola, as a new outbreak in West Africa was being vanquished by similar means.
The key to bringing the epidemic under control was something that Tamfu Muyembe started even before the international team arrived to assist. And that was recognition that this was a virus that had developed the ability to exploit human altruism. This was how it was passed, through the altruistic and loving acts between people caring for one another. The two major ways were, as you were ailing, the person who cared for you, nursed you, fed you, washed you. And then when you died, here in an area where there are no funeral parlors, so families will wash the bodies, dress them in their Sunday best, put them in the open casket, and then the loved ones will come by in the funeral and touch their loved one as a final gesture of goodbye. In these acts, the virus was passed. And Tamfu Muyembe said, well, we have to intervene. As precious as these acts are, we can't allow them to continue. We have to collect the sick and bring them to the hospital so that nobody else in the family gets infected. And we have to take the dead and bury them and not let the people have funerals, as much as this is emotionally difficult. And the first people to volunteer was the local Kikwit Red Cross. When they started doing this, the Kikwit volunteers were in street clothes, and three of them got Ebola as a result of their voluntary efforts. Nevertheless, there were 300 people on a waiting list to take their place. When Médecins Sans Frontières came in, they brought the protective gear, the rubber gloves, the rubber aprons, rubber galoshes, surgical gowns, goggles, masks, hard hats, and so on. And all of a sudden, the numbers of deaths among Red Cross volunteers ceased. It's interesting that the Red Cross here funded everything they did out of their own meager earnings. And I've already told you that there's no businesses or industry in this town. Even the petrol for their trucks was collectively raised by the Red Cross volunteers from amongst themselves. And to this day, the Kikwit Red Cross has not received a dime from the International Red Cross or the U.S. Red Cross. We did, however, donate body bags. That was the U.S. contribution, which had to be adapted for babies and specially customized. And the procedure was to take the bodies out to these mass graves for deep burial. And after the burial process was completed, they would spray disinfectant on their gloves and so on before removing their protective gear. The people saw this going on, this process of spraying, and the word got around town that there was a cure that the Red Cross carried in their backpacks but was refusing to share with everyone. And in fact, I attended one funeral where an elderly gentleman had done everything wrong. When his wife was sick, he'd cared for her. He hadn't taken her to the hospital. And when she died, he'd washed her body lovingly, laid it out in an open casket. Now the neighbors were gathered for a funeral, and the team arrived just in time, the Red Cross team, to prevent everybody from ritually touching the body. And the scientist said to him, "Look, the chances are pretty good that you're infected now. We have to take a blood test, and we think it would be a good idea if you came with us to the hospital." And he said, Just spray me. I'll be okay. Just spray me." Actually, that reminds me, another rumor that was going around town at the time was that this had nothing to do with a virus. And after all, most of these people have no germ theory of disease. So what's a virus? But rather, it had to do with diamond smuggling. The best way to get rich quick in this town is to illegally go into the south to Angola or to the north up into Mobutu's private diamond mines. Steal diamonds, swallow them, come back to Kikwit and hope to pass them. But if you're unable to pass them, then you cut a deal with the surgeon. The surgeon gets 10% for removing the diamonds from you. So the rumor around town was that the surgeons had suddenly gotten very greedy, and there was not really any Ebola, just a lot of dead diamond smugglers. But we now know the truth. There was Ebola. It's been laboratory confirmed endlessly. And we know where it started. And something interesting was noticed, same pattern in every village. This is Ndobo, and the Menga children were sent here after Gaspar and his wife died of Ebola. And six little children, the Menga family, were sent here to live together with this whole group of children and their grandmother. And two of the Menga children, little Michael Jackson Menga, named after their favorite music performer, and Bilolo Menga, died of Ebola in this hut. Their grandmother, who cared for them, then died of Ebola. And her brother, who cared for her, then died of Ebola. But it stopped cold after that. None of these children that slept with the other Menga kids got Ebola. None of the adults here who helped care for the ailing grandmother and her brother came down with the disease. And in every village, for whatever reason, which is unknown at this time, though there's a lot of speculation, the viral passage never went through more than four generations of transmission. Why? And this was before people knew it was Ebola and took appropriate precautions. The good news is we may know where this virus came from, which we never knew in previous outbreaks. Gaspar Menga made charcoal for a living. He went into the rainforest and he would get trees and put them in a big pit and burn them down into charcoal and then take the charcoal back into town and sell it as fuel. To make enough charcoal to be worth the trip, he would have to spend a couple of weeks camped out in the rainforest. He had just done so shortly before he took ill. About 37,000 insect and animal samples were collected in this rainforest area and are now at the Maximum Security Biosafety Lab in Atlanta at the CDC. Unfortunately, we can't start mashing them up right away and finding out which ones contain virus, because it turns out our knowledge of what species exist in the rainforest is so poor that we can't identify most of them. They're bringing in scientists from all over the place to assist the CDC, but it's thought that a substantial percentage of the species that have been recovered from the area have never been classified or identified. So you can't mash them up till you've at least given them a name, classified them in some way, so that you could go back and find them again in the ecology. Therefore, we're probably going to be at least a year before we'll know the answer, whether or not we've lucked out and finally found out where this virus hides when it's not causing human epidemics. The good news is we know that the virus that emerged in kikwit is identical to the strain genetically that surfaced in 1976 in Yambuku. So the virus isn't changing. Whatever reason it comes and goes has to do with us, our species, not the virus. The New Scientist, the British science publication, posed this rhetorical question: can we afford not to track deadly viruses? And I think that that's the key message here when people ask, what's all this about Ebola, or what's all this about plague in India, or what's all this about whatever remote issue, is that each of these are warning shots across the bow to our species. And each of these outbreaks provides us with lessons that we either learn or we suffer continued repetition of these things until another HIV-like agent comes forward and sweeps over successfully our entire global public health system. And there are a few things that are worth noting that I think are reasons to pause and consider why we're at greater risk today than 20 or 30 years ago. One is that we're on the move. Never before has our species been taking airplanes as much, going as many places, immigrating on the scale that we're immigrating, being refugeed out of high-intensity localized warfares as we are today. In fact, these figures on international air travel jumping in 1950 from 2 million passengers a year internationally getting on flights to another country to, by 1990, 280 million are lowball, because the 1990 level is what occurred before the fall of the Berlin Wall. Once all the Cold War restrictions on international travel were lifted, things have really soared out of control. And in fact, the International Air Transportation Association estimates that when the numbers come in the year 2000, we will have probably witnessed a logarithmic jump between the 1990 level and the year 2000 level. In fact, earlier this week at the National Academy of Sciences, they were saying that they now estimate 1 million people a day in the world cross an international border. The other trend that is occurring all over the world is urbanization. People are abandoning the rural areas and moving into the cities. The trend is rather dramatic. In North America and Europe, we basically urbanized to a fairly stable level, but it took us about 250 years to do so, to our current levels, allowing us time to build our infrastructures to support those people living in the cities in a relatively healthy manner. But look at Latin America. In 1970, 57% of the population of Latin America was urban. By 1990, 72%. And it's estimated by 2025, 84% of the population will be urban. Africa, from 23 to 32 to 54% in the same time span. When you urbanize that rapidly, you obviously cannot build supporting infrastructures, especially if your country is impoverished to begin with. Where are these urbanization patterns occurring? What are the new big cities of the future? Well, according to the United Nations, the fastest growing cities in the world that will end up by year 2000 having populations in excess of 10 million are Dhaka, Bombay, Calcutta, Delhi, Jakarta, Baghdad, Tehran, Bangkok, Istanbul, Mexico City. Any of you that have traveled to these places know what I'm talking about. The majority of the population lives in areas with substandard at best housing, no running water, no decent sewage facilities, basically microbe heaven. We also see that a global trend that in these giant cities, people are bringing their rural ecology to the urban setting. So they're co-living in highly dense situations with their pigs, their chickens, their goats, their cows, and you see the animals eating the human garbage mixed with the human waste, and then the animals defecating in areas that the humans will be in contact with. A perfect opportunity for the transmission of animal microbes to humans or, as we often see with viruses such as influenza, for the mutation of the microorganism as it goes from one species to another, coming full circle back to produce something like swine flu, which we experienced in 1918, killing 22 million people worldwide. We also see that in these areas, the garbage disposal will typically be just make a little clump, set it on fire, and hope that that takes care of garbage. The other problem we're experiencing is that even countries that had attained a reasonable level of public health infrastructural development are going backwards, and in some cases at a dramatic pace. Since the Soviet Union collapsed, most of the Soviet states are experiencing widespread epidemics, and their basic healthcare structures have collapsed. Diphtheria has now reached such a level in Russia, they're looking at 250,000 cases of an entirely preventable and curable disease. Measles, totally out of control now. Gonorrhea and syphilis, completely out of control. Tuberculosis, sweeping across all the former Soviet Union, mostly in drug-resistant forms. Pertussis, or whooping cough, completely sweeping across the region. And an interesting thing, the diphtheria epidemic in particular is sending a warning shot to us here. It turns out that all you have to do is go about 2 years without immunizing an adequate number of children, and you start to build up a high level of wild-type diphtheria in your population. And it turns out adults who are immunized as children, thought to have lifetime protection, are not able to withstand an assault when they're in their 40s, 50s, or 60s to new reintroduction of wild-type diphtheria. So what we see in Russia is that lots of the death is occurring in adults who were previously immunized against diphtheria. Just a footnote, I was mentioning this the other day at the National Academy of Sciences, and one of my colleagues, Barbara Culleton, who's the editor of Nature Medicine, one of the major medical journals in the world today, recounted the story that last year she developed severe bronchitis. She was so sick after 3 weeks she thought she literally was going to die. So her physicians put her on very powerful broad-spectrum antibiotics, and she said, "Doctor, I really need to go to this medical meeting in San Diego. It's very, very important." And he said, with classic bedside manner, "You know, you could die just as easily in San Diego as Washington. You might as well go." She went to the meeting, and quite fortunately for her, was seated next to a pediatrician who was listening to her coughing through the meeting and said, "How long have you had whooping cough?" She had been immunized fully as a child. We're seeing the microbes break past that immune protection that we thought was lifelong. And lest you think this is a third world problem, this is where we stand in the United States on successful, or I should say non-successful, immunization of our children. Less than half of all children are adequately immunized by their second birthday according to international standards. We rank behind El Salvador, behind Guatemala, behind Bangladesh in by age 2 vaccination. And, you know, we could really ask how many families would adequately vaccinate their children at all ever if it weren't illegal to go into the school system by age 5 without full vaccination.
That was journalist Laurie Garrett speaking about her book, The Coming Plague, Newly Emerging Diseases in a World Out of Balance. Among her other books are Betrayal of Trust, The Collapse of Global Public Health, published in 2001, and two works on AIDS. Eliza Graney introduced this program. To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org or visit wingsradio.org/wordpress. Our daily news feed appears at facebook.com/wingsradio. Thank you to all Wings supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. I'm Wings series producer Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.